Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Up to Date, a property law podcast brought to you by the junior barristers at Tanfield Chambers. Tune in each week for our essential property updates so you're up to date. In each 15-minute episode, we'll summarise the most important developments in the property law world, new laws and procedures coming into force, court and tribunal operations, and any changes on the horizon too. We'll also summarise and discuss a selection of new key judgments. Listen to this podcast for the key aspects of a changing landscape. Today is Monday, the 22nd of June. I'm Katie Gray, and this week I'm joined again by Deanne Oliver. Last week, we considered the extension of Practice Direction 51Z, which stays most possession proceedings until the 23rd of August. This week, we take a look at an exception to that rule, as well as recent decisions and updates from the judiciary providing guidance to lawyers about how and when other cases can be heard, how they should be listed, and when a paper determination might be appropriate. Looking forward to future possession claims currently on ice, we consider the keenly awaited case of Tracarrel House Limited and Rouncefield on the validity of Section 21 notices when no gas safety certificate was served at the start of the tenancy. Deanne, hello again.
Hello again, Katie.
So I'm excited that this week we can finally discuss some good news for landlords of residential tenancies.
Yes, so there's still no possession proceedings on the horizon, but it will now be easier to rely on the no-fault Section 21 notice once the stay on possession proceedings is lifted in the County Court.
Yeah, so after a long wait, the County Court decision of Carradine Properties and Monty Shaws has finally been reviewed by the Court of Appeal in Tracarrel House Limited and Rouncefield. Listeners will be aware, no doubt, that that decision of His Honour Judge Luber in the Central London County Court in Shaults really threw the cat amongst the pigeons in 2018 in finding that a landlord who hadn't served a gas safety certificate on the tenant before the tenant had taken up occupation of the premises couldn't ever validly serve a Section 21 notice after that, effectively turning assured shorthold tenancies into assured tenancies.
Yes, and that wasn't a binding decision, but it has caused a lot of uncertainty because some county court judges were following Shaults and some were not, and that made it very difficult to advise both landlords and tenants as to whether or not there would be a possession order made. And also, as you said, Katie, rendered Section 21 completely ineffective for a whole host of landlords.
So what did the Court of Appeal find?
So the headline is that the original sin of not serving a gas safety certificate at the start of the tenancy is remediable after all. So it's all change. The question which arose really from Luber's judgment is why was the reading of the gas safety certificate regulation creating a result that was so much more onerous than in cases where landlords had breached other regulations. So for example, if a landlord fails to protect a tenancy deposit, they can be penalised in all sorts of ways, including being made to pay a fine to their tenants. But they would always in the end be able to serve and rely on a Section 21 notice as soon as they remedied their breach. But this really restrictive reading of the gas safety regulation gave a much more onerous and disproportionate punishment in relation to breaches relating to failure to serve such a certificate. And what the Court of Appeals found is that that may be a literal reading, but it's one that undermines the point of assured shorthold tenancies to such a level that it can't be what Parliament intended.
Yeah, it really comes down to bad drafting, and it is fair to say that the construction preferred by the Court of Appeal does rather strain the wording of Regulation 2.2 of the Prescribed Requirements Regulations. In fact, Lord Justice Moyland gave a dissenting judgment in the Court of Appeal, finding that he just couldn't read the regulations in the same way that the majority had done, given the words used in the regulations. And he pointed out that the requirement to serve a gas safety certificate is, frankly, an important measure to make sure that tenants are safe during their occupation of the property. And so therefore, it wasn't surprising that landlords faced a heavy sanction for failure to comply with the prescribed requirements. But he was in the minority. The majority found, as you've described, Deanne, and that is a decision that will be welcomed by landlords. And the other question is, Is this the end of the matter? Because the Learned Housing Law blog, Nearly Legal, identified in a recent post that the decision of the Court of Appeal doesn't deal with the not uncommon situation where no gas safety record is served on the tenant before the tenant takes up occupation because no check has been carried out. So what happens in that scenario? Is that an irremediable breach? Well, Nearly Legal thinks it is, and so that's open to further arguments. And also the Court of Appeal in their decision, though coming to a firm conclusion on the construction of the regulations, didn't actually give any practical solutions to parties as to how landlords are supposed to remedy their breach. So are they supposed to serve every gas safety certificate on the tenant before they serve a Section 21 notice? Do they only need to serve the current gas safety certificate? That's not addressed in the judgment, so the door is open for further arguments. And I suppose the safest way forward is for the landlord to serve everything that he's got in terms of gas safety certificates before a Section 21 notice is served, so that there can be no arguments on that point. Moving on to law and procedure in a COVID era. When can a hearing take place in person, and when should it be heard on the papers or adjourned? We consider new cases and guidance from the courts and tribunals. Listeners will recall that last week we talked about the exceptions to Practice Direction 51Z and the fact that those exceptions were likely to be incredibly rare indeed. Well, we've now got an example of an exceptional exception. In Copeland and Bank of Scotland, the handing down of a reserved judgment following a hotly contested trial was held to amount to an exception to Practice Direction 51Z, although the judge did make it clear that that decision was limited to its own facts and wasn't necessarily to be used as a guide for other cases. In addition, though the stay imposed by the Practice Direction was lifted, the enforcement of the actual possession order itself was stayed until after the end of Practice Direction 51Z, whenever that will be, and the time to apply for permission for a second appeal was extended until after that date as well. The decision in Copeland and Bank of Scotland, for me at least, is interesting because it shows how public health can be protected by simply imposing a stay on a possession order, whilst at the same time getting on with efficiently conducting litigation in this time of crisis, by handing down the judgment. And it does show, again, as we discussed last time, what a blunt instrument the Practice Direction is in putting a halt to any and all possession work, no matter what the circumstances of the case. It's true to say that there's going to be a huge backlog of work come the end of August, or such later time as the Practice Direction is extended to, and the courts are going to need to find some way to put a dent into all of that work. One proposal I've heard recently is to open what are going to be termed Nightingale courts in large public buildings. Another is inevitably going to be flexible court hours, with courts opening earlier in the morning, later at night, possibly at weekends. And in a moment, Deanne is going to fill us in on some of the proposals for the future at Central London and Mersey and City County Courts.
Deanne, turning to the FTT, there's been a recent case about its jurisdiction to determine matters on papers alone, which is timely because the FTT's powers to do that have recently been extended in light of the restrictions on in-person hearings due to coronavirus.
Yes, so Katie, the case that we're talking about is Enterprise Home Developments and Adam. And that was an upper tribunal case where the FTT below had ordered a paper determination at a very early stage and before the issues in the case were really clear. But the way that the FTT had made that direction was to say that unless either party opted out, then it would be on paper. And that was unfortunately despite the fact that both of the parties were acting in person. So the upper tribunal looked at this and concluded several things that are going to be highly relevant to the listing of cases during this pandemic. So the takeaways are, don't list on paper unless you know what the issues are. When you do know what the issues are, then keep your listing direction under review. When your parties are in person, then don't, as a judge, just leave the decision about listing up to them. If you do decide as a judge that you would like a paper determination because it will work, you think, then give the parties some guidance and directions so that they know what they have to do. And then lastly, really don't go for a paper determination at all where there are disputes of fact, broadly speaking, because it's probably going to be quite difficult to make that work.
Yeah, interestingly, the upper tribunal referred to the specialist expertise of the FTT and pointed out that that expertise isn't just limited to assessing the reasonableness of service charges, but is also there to ensure that lay parties can bring their own cases to their best advantage and to use the judge's own questioning skills to gain a full understanding of the relevant facts. So that seems to me to be suggesting that where the parties are not represented, a paper determination rather, will often not be appropriate.
Yes, and what we might forget is that if you're a litigant in person and you end up going to a paper determination, you may not have any contact with any lawyer or judge face-to-face or verbally at all in the whole length of proceedings. And really, that can't be something that we want to have in the future.
Well, finally then, talking about face-to-face contact with judges, Deanne, you've recently attended a talk at which judges were looking back at the first few months of virtual hearings, and that included some judges that sit at the Central London County Court.
Yes, so what the judges said was that there have been now more and more in-person hearings. So, for example, antisocial behaviour injunction orders and committals had to be heard in person, but also court staff have adapted to the new world that we're living in, and they've done a lot of work to make sure that in-person hearings can go ahead. So while there are going to be a lot of hearings that are by telephone or by video, we are also going to see more and more cases going back in front of judges.
So did you get any indications from that talk about how the future is going to look?
Yes, so in the immediate future, there was an indication that the County Court in Central London and also Mayors and City are going to be open again quite shortly. And the description of the new court is that there'll be trays for documents, doorstops, lots of cleaning controls, and marked out black tape for people to know where to stand in the courts. However, what the judges have said, and like the fact that a lot of the hearings we're going to have will still be done virtually, is that that isn't something that they really want going forward on a permanent basis, because they're not convinced that virtual hearings promote access to justice, and they also feel that those hearings take a lot longer, are a lot more tiring, and don't necessarily give the parties the satisfaction that a face-to-face hearing would.
Well, maybe we'll meet again across a socially distanced waiting room at Mayors and City County Court. I can only hope.
Well, I do hope so, Katie.
Thanks, Deanne. That's all for this second episode. We hope you join us again next time. The cases we talked about today were Tracarrel House Limited in Rouncefield, a 2020 decision of the Court of Appeal, Copeland and Bank of Scotland PLC, a 2020 decision of the Queen's Bench Division, and Enterprise Home Developments LLP and Adam, a 2020 decision of the Upper Tribunal. If you want to hear more about Enterprise Home Developments and Adam, Amanda Gourlay, a fellow member of Chambers and award-winning blogger, covers the case in detail on her blog, Law and Lease. You can subscribe to and download this podcast on Spotify and Google Podcasts, as well as listening on the Tanfield Chambers website. Please also follow us on Twitter at UpToDatePodcast. We'd love to hear from you if there's anything you'd like us to cover in the next episode. And please share with your colleagues if you found this podcast useful. Tune in next time for a new episode, and we'll keep you up to date.